The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because
have made
they are hard.
4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show by Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners, and, well, it's good morning, California time. Welcome to our Friday Space Show program. Great to be here. I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you all for tuning in. It's a holiday weekend, given Monday is Columbus Day. I hope for all of you it's a terrific weekend, a lot of fun, a safe one, an enjoyable one. For those of you who pay attention to sports, it's the beginning of the postseason for professional baseball. San Francisco is loaded with events from Fleet Week to the Navy Blue Angels to also sorts of cool events around Fisherman's Wharf. So if you're a tourist in the Bay Area, you're going to have a ball this weekend, and I'm sure that's the same where most of you are located. So make the most of it, and thanks again for tuning in, and we hope you're going to enjoy and learn from today's Space Show program. Our toll-free number for those of you who would like to call and speak with our guest, Walt Anderson, is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, there are no call screeners. Please be patient. Let the phone ring. We'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. I have the phone disconnected to allow Walt a few minutes to be able to talk and bring you up to date and tell you what's going on in his life and his new business. I'll announce it when I open the line, but I really think that he should have that opportunity before we take questions, either email or by the phone. Also, do remember you can email us, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then please also remember that we're copyrighted and trademarked. You do have permission to download our programs and share them. The 90-minute show is roughly 40 megabytes. If you need any assist in how to share a 40-megabyte file, then email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. But I usually use transferbigfiles.com, and you can walk yourself through that. It's pretty easy. We podcast. We thank Andrew at gigadial.net. He is our podcasting client. Our podcasting services are in quite a few places on the net, including iTunes, Microsoft, Zoom, and a host of other places as well. And the RSS URL, if you would like to subscribe to our podcast, is on our website and our newsletter. If you do have any podcasting questions, let me know, at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And that is our website, thespaceshow.com. So we have a comprehensive newsletter. It's uploaded onto the website Sunday evening, and you can't miss it. It's in big letters in about the middle of the page. And it has all of the week's programming in detail, the guest bios, and it's also, as I keep saying, the only place where we have a future events section. And then if we have to change programming or get announcements out to you, it shows up first on the website newsletter, and then later it goes out by email. And on our website also, you will find social media buttons. And next to those social media buttons is something called Guest Search. So there you can do a global search for your favorite space show topic, like microgravity, for example, or your favorite guest, and then pull up all of the dates when those topics have been discussed or that guest has been on the show, and then you can pull those programs up on our archives on our main website because it searches per date down at the bottom. And everything we do is archived, going back to the beginning of the Space Show in 2001. We're approaching 2,000 Space Show programs, and you can listen right off of our website or easily download the program. There's a store. You'll see it up at the top, Space Show Gear. Check it out when you can. And then remember, we're a nonprofit, 501c3, with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. You'll see a Support the Space Show button there. That's probably the most important thing on our website, because without your financial support, the Space Show will disappear into the ether. So we thank those of you who do support us and help us out. Remember, if you are paying U.S. taxes, you do get a deduction, the same if you're a California taxpayer. And again, we appreciate your support. It is vital to our health. And then remember, the Space Show is brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation. And Secure World Foundation helps to promote cooperative solutions for space security. Please get more information about them on their fine website, www.swfound.org. They are also the sponsors of our webinar series, and we have two more webinars scheduled at this time for this year, October 28th and November 25th. And we may have, one more as well for 2012. And then this brings me to today's program. One more announcement. Our Tuesday, October 16th show that I have been promoting, 7 to 9 p.m. California time, is the special audition show for self-invited guests and people who would like to be a guest on the Space Show. So this is your opportunity. You get 10 minutes or so to call us and show us why and tell us why you should be a guest on the Space Show. I've not done this before. I hope it's a successful program. We're about to find out. Tuesday, October 16th, 7 to 9 p.m. There are no limits on what your ideas or topics can be, other than they should be space-related or maybe science-related. So again, Tuesday, October 16th is that special program, 7 to 9 p.m. California time. Well, our guest today really needs no introduction to frequent Space Show listeners and to people in the space community. Walt Anderson is back among us, and we welcome him back to his freedom and to rejoining the space community. Walt is a notice space commerce financier and businessman. He has been a huge commercial success in the telecom business with many different companies and operations, including Esprit Telecom. He's been an investor in some of the new space companies. He has been a supporter of FIND and some of the space advocate organizations, especially earlier on, Space Frontier Foundation. Walt, as you know, did have his problems legally and with the DOJ, and we are glad that after 7 years and 7 months, he is back among us, and it's great to talk to Walt after an absence of several years from the Space Show. Welcome back, and we're glad you're back among us all, Walt. How are you?
Well, I'm much better now, thank you.
Hopefully. How have you seen things change? I mean, I know you had contact with a lot of us. We sent you, reading material. I mean, you weren't in isolation, so to speak. So you saw the space industry, I assume, really change over the last 7.5 years. Can you talk about that?
Yes, I can. I actually was in isolation for 7 months as part of the process of softening me up for a confession. But after that, I was in an environment where I could get reading material, and people in the space community in particular who had worked with me before and knew me had were nice enough to send me lots of materials and interesting things, which I read every one. Actually, the last 5 years has been very, very positive for the space industry. A lot of the efforts that have been made by many, many people over a long period of time have come to some positive conclusions. One thing was simply the policy of the United States government. While there was a lot of talk about space commercialization, there genuinely now seems to be a policy allowing commercial space. There certainly wasn't in the prior government in power. And this has opened a lot of doors for a number of companies, and those companies were ready to step through those doors. And one of them, obviously, is SpaceX. Elon Musk has done what we knew should have been done, cheaper access to space, but he's done it brilliantly, and he's done it successfully, and he has a significant number of commercial customers. He's not dependent on the government for the survival of his business, which is a very positive thing. X-Corp, which was started with very little resources, has done amazing things with the resources they have, and apparently I've heard that they were had a successful round of investment recently, and they deserve it because they've done very good things with what they had. Richard Branson has chosen to enter the market for touristic space activities, and he's been able to get investment in spaceports and other things with his support and backing of the business. Those are just three things. I'm not going to try to survey the whole market. I just say that back when Space Frontier Foundation was originally formed by Rick Tumlinson and Bob Werb in around 1988 time frame, I think it was then, the goal was that we would have commercial space activities, not cost-plus contractors, not the business as usual with NASA, but true commercial space. Well, we're there now. Not everything's been done. There's a whole path to go down to do all the interesting things that we've been talking about for 20 years. But the beginning, we have a beginning now and a path to walk, and it's very, very exciting. And I really admire the people who've been out here fighting the battles on a daily basis, doing the little details to make these businesses possible and successful.
Do you think the new commercial space industry is ready for investment yet? In fact, you have a couple of emails about that have come in before the show. And as we just started, one, even though it's a little bit early for questions, but Richard sent in a question wondering if you think that new space technologies are ready for investment. What sectors, you know, that type of thing. Are we there yet, or is there still some development that needs to take place before it becomes really an investment attractive?
Well, I think there are certainly companies who are already out there who have plans that are realistic, that have ideas that can be done with the technology we have today, and perhaps they can improve that technology, but they can still do it with what we know is available today. And also, even more important, have the right management team, the right people involved, because I've done a lot of business activities. I've had some very good successes, and I've had some failures. And each of those has informed me, and I've learned perhaps more from the failures as I have from the successes. Certainly in the space field, I backed companies that had great ideas, things that I really wanted to see happen. And I wanted to see them happen so much that I may have been partly blinded to the weaknesses of the managers who were trying to make that happen. And so the money that I invested in those managers was perhaps somewhat wasted. And I could have, in hindsight, having learned, I could have better held on to those funds and waited until maybe an idea came along that wasn't quite as exciting, but that was realistic and backed by people who were willing to put the effort in both and who had the expertise and ability and prior track record to make it work. Somebody clearly like Elon Musk fits all those categories, and look at the results. The results are very positive. X-Corp has a team of engineers and people who had a vast amount of experience and had some failures behind them and some successes, but they made the most of it, and look at the results. So the three areas, big areas that I hope to see in space that I really believe could justify investment are the resources related to asteroid resources. There are a large amount of resources out in space. It can benefit people on the planet if it's done correctly. There are technologies available now that could begin moving towards a profitable business in asteroid resource capture. Space solar power is an idea whose time may have come. Previously, all the studies of space solar power showed that it just wasn't quite economically viable. It just didn't quite make, the numbers weren't quite make. Now, there are three factors that have changed. The cost of oil and other energy resources has gone up many, many times since those studies. Second, the cost of getting to space has gone down substantially due to the competitive space industry. And third, we can now get resources from space with the available robotic and other technologies. We can use resources that are already in space. We don't have to bring everything up from Earth to build space solar power. And I'm not going to try to give detailed analysis of where it's that viable. I think that countries near the equator can probably use the ground-based solar power very effectively, wind and geothermal and other things very effectively. But there's a region of Earth that has a lot of population that can benefit from space solar power, and I think it's economical. I think somebody needs some, and I'm perfectly happy to be involved in that business. I would like to be involved in that business in the future. I have no specific plans, but I certainly would be willing to go out, and I believe I could make a good case for an investor to put money into space solar power. I believe that in developing the specific technology, we could put enough patents in place and enough knowledge in place that we could be the first mover and have a very strong advantage in the future. The third area is a little more speculative and more hard to justify investment, but I believe that space habitats are very important. And I'm talking about something much bigger than the mere space station. I'm talking about a habitat that is very large, that can hold thousands of people, and that rotates to create an artificial gravity, because I personally do not believe people are well designed to live very far outside one gravity. We've had hundreds of thousands, or actually billions of years of evolution that have shaped our DNA and our makeup to make it so we live in a gravity-bound environment, and I don't think it's going to be easy. So with a habitat, we can recreate that environment. People have been building habitats for a long time. Humans are very good at it, and we've gotten better in the last couple hundred years. Look at the giant ocean liners that hold thousands and thousands of people and can withstand massive waves and storms. Much more harsh environment than one would encounter in outer space. So that's the one that I really want to see, and the one that I can't quite make a good argument financially. Where is the payback? When is the payback? But the other two, space solar power and the asteroid resources, I think are there now. There's a justifiable reason to invest in those.
Speaking about space management, which you focused on a few minutes ago, if you were running a space mutual fund, for example, would you be looking to space businesses and their management teams to have different qualities and characteristics than you were if you were just engaged in regular risk-oriented terrestrial businesses? Would the management teams be that different for a good space company?
Well, surprisingly not. I've learned. I have made investments, as I said, in some people who were very visionary, who genuinely wanted to accomplish their goals, who genuinely believe in new space, competitive space, but were unable to do that. They themselves may not have been up to the task, or they may not have attracted the management team they needed. And in some cases, they were just trying to do something that wasn't possible at that time. They were, or there were forces aligned against them. I feel that with MIRCorps, we had some very strong forces aligned against us who would do anything to destroy the company, and they succeeded. But I think we had a good management team, and I think if we hadn't had the United States government actively threatening our potential partners, threatening the government agency in Russia to have the the Russian private partner destroy the Mir. If that had not happened, I believe the public offering would have gone forward, Mir would have been renovated, and it would have been a valuable resource. But that's in the past, and it's not something I could do anything about except to be aware of what forces you're fighting against. Now there's a much more positive atmosphere. I don't think that a company that was trying to build a space solar power station would find tremendous opposition from any U.S. government at this, or any world government at this point, I should say. I don't think any organization who is responsibly pursuing asteroid investment, and by responsible I mean both giving the investors a realistic idea of the risks and prospects, and second, being very, very concerned with safety factors involving the activities they're doing on such a large scale. But I don't see that causing any problems now. It's a new day. And so I would think that the management team, though, would have to be very, very similar to any successful startup. You need the people who have the knowledge, who have you also need people who have some experience. Now, nobody's built space solar power, but there are people who've built very large solar installations, who've done very large manufacturing projects, who've done very large planning projects. So you would want to bring in the people who had a lot of experience in doing things as close as possible similar, but at the same time, because it is a visionary idea, you'd want to find someone who genuinely believed in the cause, who would maybe go above and beyond because they thought what they were doing was going to change the world in a positive way. There are people out there like that. I meet them every day. I see them. I've met them in the past in the space community, and I know they're out there and ready to go. We just have to find a way to create these commercial entities and convince the public that there's a real opportunity that will not only return their investment, but will make the world a better place for everyone.
To kind of lean on some of my experience, let me see if this is an analogy that you can accept, or I'm off in left field someplace. When I was in graduate school and doing my MBA and doctoral program in the 70s in San Francisco, a lot of my professors came from Bechtel, which is a huge, big project engineering and manufacturing organization globally in San Francisco. So a lot of the financial side of how to design big projects and do the economics, my professors came out of Bechtel, and they were all PhDs from various schools around the country. But they were building huge power plants in the Middle East in the 70s and other really mammoth big projects. So taking people with that kind of experience, I know I'm going back to the 70s, so that's a long time ago, and extrapolating that experience into a big space solar power kind of operation, that's kind of the experience, the background that would probably be applicable, even though it's not per se space solar power?
Well, it certainly could be. And, for example, a number of years ago, a Japanese construction company, Shimizu, designed as an internal project a space station. I don't think they really thought for sure they were going to build it, but it was an exercise to demonstrate their capabilities, their creative thinking, and so part of it is the knowledge. Shimizu had knowledge of big construction projects, but also that creativity and enthusiasm to design something that unique and that special. I think you combine the two, the actual experience and knowledge in as close an area as you can find, since these things haven't been done yet, and combine it with somebody who's genuinely enthusiastic about doing something unique and who genuinely believes that what they're doing is going to have a positive effect on the world. I think those combinations can create a management team that can do these tasks.
Listeners, I am opening the toll-free line. It is 1-866-687-7223. George is in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and he says, Walt, there is a push for public-private partnerships to do various things in space exploration and space development. How do you see public-private partnerships?
Okay. I see them positively, with one caveat. Public-private partnerships assume private is fine. The public part is where you can get into trouble. If the public is a government that's substantially involved in war-making and violent activities. And I'll give you two examples. When Orbital Recovery Corporation was then discussed with the European Space Agency, a space agency that has no military components to it, there's no secret files or launches of secret payloads on their craft. And we discussed some public-private partnership thing, and that was very comfortable because everybody could be completely open and transparent, and we knew that whatever technology transfer occurred, whatever we provided to the public side, would be used for the benefit of the citizens of the European Union, but would never be used in a war-making capacity, would never kill people. I would not have that same confidence in a public-private partnership involving the United States government. In fact, I'd be almost certain that any technology that could be used to kill people would be taken and potentially, possibly used for that purpose. So I think one, and that's just me. Maybe somebody else feels morally comfortable helping develop technology that can be used to kill and murder, but I don't. So I would never involve myself in a public partnership with certain public entities. But there are many public entities on the planet that are working for the positive good of mankind, and I would those partnerships work well if they're properly structured.
So I guess the bottom line then would be you have to really carefully evaluate what the partnership is about and what the public entity is that you're wanting to work with.
Yeah, find somebody that you're compatible both management-wise and perhaps moral-wise compatible with, so that there are no future problems as the technology actually gets used. Assume you're going to be successful and what might happen. And if the answer are positive, great to go forward with a public-private partnership.
Okay, and again, listeners, just to remind you, I've now opened the phone lines if you would like to call and talk with Walt, 1-866-687-7223. I know you're starting a new business, and it's not directly space-related, but can you let's spend a few minutes and talk about your new business, too.
Okay, I can't say too much because I am, when you say I'm starting a new business, it's a new idea. I've working with some other people on it, other partners who are critical to the success of that business. It does involve a virtual computing aspect, and I really can't say a lot more because we're kind of reserving the right to, as the company moves forward and develops something, which we haven't yet completed yet, we're kind of reserving the right to make a announcement about that in a sort of timely and strategic way. But I did start doing some research on this and study on this while I would add lots of time to do research and study. And I'm enthused about it. It's one of the things that I very much want to work for. And my experience has been that I've earned a lot of money in high technology companies and spent a lot of money in space. So I guess this is my way of trying to go back to a high technology company and earn a lot of money again, because right now I don't have any. I was financially destroyed. My last dollar was spent on lawyers fighting my legal case. I ultimately had a public defender, and so I need to get to work. And this is one of the first tasks that I plan to do, among other things. But I can't say a lot more about it because my partners would be angry at me if I did right now.
Okay. Can you tell us how the high-tech world has changed over the past 7 years from when you were doing telecoms and work like that? We on the consumer side, I mean, just, you know, looking at the high-tech gadgetry that I hold in my hand and have sitting on my on my desk is unbelievable, and it wasn't even around 7 years ago.
Well, let me tell you, within the first 72 hours of being released from the dungeons where I was held, I really enjoyed the technology. I was able to talk to people all over the world on Skype. I was able to hold in my hands iPhone and other high technology gadgets that were really, really worked pretty well. I actually was able to use a Windows version that didn't always go to the blue screen of death, but only did that once in a while. That was fascinating. It's great. I mean, I've been reading about Skype, and I got to use it for the first time within a few hours of being released. I certainly read all the hype about iPhone, and I found out that iPhone and its many competitors have some genuinely great technology that increases efficiency. Okay, and I finally found that I could install a scanner, and it worked instead of spending more time than copying the document by hand. So I'm embracing scanning technology because it actually works well now without wasting time. Just in the, you know, electronic gizmos. So I like gizmos, and I'm having a lot of fun with them right now.
Could you have imagined, the evolution to these kinds of gizmos and the power that you could hold in your hand with a technical gizmo? Could you have imagined that 7 years ago?
I could. In 2002, I set up a company, an investment group called Comverge, which was the idea of communications convergence, and that has happened. Most communications now rides on the same pipes with digital pipes. You no longer have this separation of 18 different kinds. You have one kind of pipe for one thing and another kind of pipe. That's not all completely happened yet, but it's well on the way to the convergence of data and voice and everything into a single network, which allows a tremendous amount of efficiency and easier management of the process. And so I've had some vision of this because I had planned to make a lot of money riding that wave. Unfortunately, I was busy doing something else during the last 7 years and 7 months. So I'm getting to enjoy the results of that wave, but I didn't get to enjoy the financial benefits of being part of it. But that's okay. There's always another wave coming.
By the way, just as an aside, I know that while you were in New Jersey, you were taking care of some feral cats and things. Were you doing that at the end? I'm just curious, what happened to the cats?
Well, the process is that something that if you have feral cats and you know anything, go to a website, Alley Cat Allies, and they talk about how to deal with it. And the program that has been kind of accepted by most of the humane societies and the major organizations is called Trap, Neuter, Release. The idea is you take the feral cats, which are producing more cats, you trap them, and you send them out to get an operation so they can't have more babies. And then you bring them back to their home territory where they're comfortable, where they know how to live, and you release them. And then, of course, if you're me, you continue to feed them do whatever you can to take care of them. But some of these cats are extremely afraid of humans and get extremely upset when humans try to touch them or take care of them. So they really can't become house pets. They're going to have to live out their life in the outdoors, in their territories. Luckily, they seem to be able to find the shelter they need for the winter and seem to be able to take care of themselves, because I had some cats that continued to come around to get their dinner at a certain time every day for 5 years. And eventually one of them actually let me pet her. But other cats we would pick up in the trapping phase, we would quickly discover that they were just a house cat that had gotten lost or been abandoned by the owner. So those cats were shipped off to the nearby no-kill shelter to be given a home. And before we got a handle on this, the area there where I was living was producing over 100 kittens every year. significant portion of those kittens would eventually die because it just couldn't support, the territory couldn't support that many cats. Before I left, we had one set of kittens in the last year, and that was from one female cat that we were never able to trap because she was much smarter than I am and figured everything I tried to do out. But that's a big improvement, and we could deal with 6 to 8 kittens a year from that one candidate. So I encourage people who are living with communities, the feral cats, to help solve the problem. It can be done. We were able to reduce our community of problem cats breeding and multiplying, going in the dumpster. Sometimes when people would throw away the trash, the cat would get angry or scared and bite somebody. We eliminated that down to a small community of cats that were knew where they were going to live, were comfortable, they were getting fed. And when I left there, two other people who very much like cats wanted to step up and take over the program. So I think it's being well taken care of. And the only thing I miss is kittens. Every few months I'd get to play with some kittens, and I'm missing kittens right now.
Here's kind of a strange question that came in from Ben, and he's in Oklahoma City. And he says, David, I'm listening at work, can't use the phone call. This is probably strange because it's not space-related, but we see lots of movies on television and in the theater about prisoners being released, and they've made friends for life, and they're carrying messages to others on the outside. Please ask Walt if he made prison friends for life. Was he asked to carry messages? Do people run their organizations from inside, or is that all just movie talk?
Well, I guess there is a lot of movie stereotypes about prisons, and one of the ones that's most fascinating, when people came to visit me, they'd look around the visiting room, and after I confessed, I was moved from the dungeons of the D.C. jail to an open minimum security. We didn't have any walls or fences. We could have walked away anytime we wanted. And so the visitors come, they look at these prisoners, and instead of seeing these lean, mean, dangerous characters that you always see in the prison films, they would see mostly some very overweight, under-emotionally developed, sometimes sick, sometimes people sometimes who could had trouble walking, or and many of them ex-drug addicts who had simply gotten in jail because they had been selling drugs to feed their habit. It's not what you see on prison. Most of the people in there are obviously people that I would hope never get out of prison because they are dangerous, violent people who will harm someone if they can. But most of the prisoners were people who had been involved in drugs themselves. They were addicts, and they decided they couldn't afford their habit anymore without selling it. They sold it to some friends and then sold it to the wrong person. They got in jail. And with the minimum mandatory sentencing, someone could sell a fairly small amount of drugs and get a mandatory sentence of 10 years. There were people in the prison across the road from where I stayed in a minimum security facility with big fences and barbed wire who had life sentences for a single nonviolent drug transaction. And so that's who's there. The most dangerous, I found more dangerous than the inmates from my own perspective were the staff. I rarely felt threatened by any of the inmates. I'm not saying some of them weren't slightly threatening people, but the biggest threats to my health and well-being and my life came from the members of the staff of the D.C. jail and the decisions they made about things. Not the inmates. Even though there are plenty of crazy, damaged people there, there were also a lot of unfortunate people that in another society, they would have been left alone and eventually might have gone to a drug treatment center and resolved some of the problems that made their life less happy. Instead, they've been put in prison for 10, 20 years, and by the time they get out, they have very little opportunity. Rehabilitation and correction doesn't exist anymore in the United States, at least not on the federal level. I tried to set up a computer training program for inmates in a minimum security prison because every one of them was going to get out in the next few years. Every one of them would need to use a computer in their work, even if they were a warehouse truck operator or something, they would need to sometimes go to a computer to pull logs, to get email updates about their job. So we suggested that we get a bunch of old computers disconnected from the Internet and train people to use basic office and email functions. The prison authorities refused. They don't want people trained. They don't want to prepare anybody for the future. Now, it's sad, but that's what we found. They don't offer the most basic classes of skills that people need when they get back to the real world.
So it's really different than what we hear about and see in the news shows even or things like that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just not that way. I mean, now states, there are some states that are doing some very progressive and positive things. So I'm talking about my experience in the federal government and in D.C., which is a subsidiary of the prison system in D.C. is a subsidiary of the federal government. In terms of lifetime friendship, the truth is most of the people there came from a different socioeconomic background than me. And so while I may have had friendly relationship with them, it wasn't realistic that I would have a lifetime friendship because I don't have a lot of things in common with a high school dropout who's a drug addict, truthfully. I can be sympathetic with them. I could talk to them and be with them in a friendly way, but I don't have it's unlikely I'll establish that lifetime connection because I just don't have enough in common or enough problems perhaps in common with them or experiences. I did meet a few people there who I felt some connection to. One of them was a fellow who helped me take care of the cats, who had four cats waiting for him at home, and who had made a mistake in relation to a transaction with his company, which he admitted and was very contrite about. I believe he'll go back and become a positive member of society and will never make that kind of mistake again. But he was, somebody who I had some commonality with in terms of background. There were other people that I felt were in there as well, a percentage of them who were also I felt were in there for the wrong, were not criminals at all and had been put in prison based on false pretenses. Every human endeavor has an error rate. Everything humans do has some error rate, and the criminal justice system seems to have an exceptionally high error rate considering the consequences it imposes on others. In Illinois, there was a situation where they did all the DNA tests on people where that was applicable, and 5% of the people were exonerated by the DNA test, absolutely could not have done what they said they were going to do. Well, 5% doesn't sound that big until you realize that those 5% of the people, their lives were ripped to pieces by this process. They were accused in some cases of violent rape or violent crimes. They were taken away from their families. Their families often suffered hardships. 5% is a big number when you consider the consequences. Now, if 5% of the violent criminals in Illinois are not guilty as charged, what does that mean about the cases that don't get as much scrutiny? So that's just something to think about. I do have a few people I'll be in touch with in the future, but I think I tried to keep my mind out in the real world because that's where I came from and that's where I'm going to be living now. There are people who go to prison for 20 years who become inmates, true inmates of the system. They live in the system. They learn everything about it. Their lives become being about being there and how to adapt. I, at every moment, resisted doing that, and maybe it made my life a little harder, but at every moment I focused on what was out here, my family, my friends, my associates, what I wanted to do, what I wanted to accomplish. I caught up on all my personal reading. I have studied every French author I've ever wanted to read, everything they ever read, every English author, every Spanish author, and a few others. And I caught up on my technical reading so that while I never touched an iPhone, I knew a lot about iPhones. And while I'd never designed previously a virtualized computer system, I learned a lot about everything from how to set up the data center to the cost of every element. I had a lot of time. And but I think that people should not believe what they're told. If you go to Europe and let's say you went to Holland and visited a prison there, and then you went and visited the D.C. jail, you would think that that one was an advanced country and one was a medieval country, and it would be the D.C. jail that would be medieval. And you would be very disappointed to be associated with that kind of abuse and treatment of human beings. Even though you know some of them are dangerous, nasty people, some of them are just the alcoholic that got picked up for being in the wrong place, the drug addict who sold some drugs to a friend because he desperately needed the money for his own habit, maybe another person who made some other types of mistakes. But no one should be treated the way American prisoners are treated and abused.
Here's a hard question for you, and then we'll go to break. This is Carl in Tucson. He says, David, I'm at my office listening, can't use the telephone. You know the Friday drill. Walt, I haven't really paid much attention to your situation since I heard your last jailhouse interviews with David several years ago, in which you did talk about your situation, your problems, what you were going through, and your attempts to appeal with the IRS, etc. As I recall, you had several hundred million dollars of liens placed against you or future assets from various federal jurisdictions. Do those liens still exist? And if you raise new money for your new business venture, does the government take that money?
Yeah, I think that's an important point, because I do plan to go out and do business, operate businesses. I am still appealing elements of the tax court case, and there's still a possibility, and I say that very almost humorously, because it's still the U.S. courts that will decide, but there at least is a theoretical possibility that the court could decide that I did not commit a tax fraud for those 2 years. Courts have already decided that I didn't commit a tax fraud for the other 3 years that I was originally accused of. So we have a situation where a tax court has determined that I absolutely positively had no tax liability for the year 1995, 1996, and 1997. And on the exact same income, facts, law, everything for 1998 and 1999, I did commit the crime. So it's an odd, it's illogical, it's impractical, and legally there's a legal concept called issue preclusion that would make it, that I should win. But I don't believe that the U.S. the court system has judges anymore. I think we have government apparatchiks and government stooges. That's only my opinion, of course. So I don't believe it's likely that I'll win my tax court appeal. So what's likely to happen is what your caller suggested. I will have a lien against that, or I will have claims by the government against my assets. Whether there's a lien or not, they'll still have a legal claim. That legal claim is exactly the same as if someone sued you and you got a judgment against you. In other words, if someone sues you and you get a judgment against you, that person can take steps to collect the money. They can garnish your wages. They can put a lien against your home. If you have a bank account with money in it, they can go and seize that bank account. They can't, though, seize the assets of a company in which you are, a limited liability company in which you are involved, because that isn't yours. You're an investor or a participant. So if I were to be like this new business I'm anticipating, if we set up a corporation and I were to become an investor, shareholder, partner, whatever, that corporation wouldn't be in trouble. It would be my assets that would be in trouble.
So your common stock, for example, or investor stock would be in trouble.
Right. Now, I'm actually in the odd situation that I'm going to have to spend money. In other words, unless I plan, since I never had hundreds of millions of dollars, and let's assume for purposes that I'm going to lose the tax court case.
Uh-huh.
If I never had hundreds of millions of dollars, I don't have it. I don't have hidden assets. So, and unless I become tremendously wealthy again, I will never have hundreds of millions of dollars to give the U.S. government. So I have two possibilities. Either I can negotiate with them a settlement of some kind, which basically they give – the government often takes people where they're convinced they don't have assets. They simply wipe the debt out because they say, we can't collect it. You don't have the money. That will be difficult in my case because it's a highly politicized case, and but it may be possible. If that's not, then I have to. Am I simply going to live in a box on the street and give the government every dollar I earn and eat garbage? No, I'm not going to do that. I will have to organize my life in a way that I can place the assets that I earn outside of the ability of the U.S. government to seize them. And that really means that I'm going to have to do now what I was accused of doing, of hiding assets. I'm going to have to, I won't hide them. If I, let's say, open a bank account in Canada, and I tell the IRS every year when I file my taxes, I have a bank account in Canada. I haven't hidden anything from them, but it's unlikely that they can go take the money out of my bank account in Canada because it would be difficult for them to do that. So instead of hiding assets from the IRS, I simply have to put them out of reach if I'm ever going to be able to go out to dinner again or own anything. And that's an unfortunate situation that I find uncomfortable, but I would find it more uncomfortable to, as I say, live on the street and eat garbage, which would be the result if I didn't take steps to protect my assets from the seizure by the U.S. government. I'm hoping that a negotiation can be done, and I'm being very candid here, and not cagey. I'm not a politician. I'm not a diplomat. I'm not afraid to admit that I inhaled. I'm not going to ever run from office. This is a situation I find myself in, and my business partners will have to understand this. I have a great track record. I can lead and grow businesses. I've made hundreds of people, more than 100 people, or have earned more than $1 million through collaborating with me. Some of those people earned more than $100 million by collaborating with me, a number of them. And so if people can take the legal advice that they will probably get that says they're not risking their own assets by being my partner, it's me that has to worry about it, I'm sure that there'll be people who will be happy to be my partner based on my track record.
I don't know much about the foreign banking law, but I do understand the problem comes in by not declaring that you have the accounts, and if any taxes are due, not paying the taxes on any interest earned or anything like that. So as long as you declare you have X in Canada and you show any earnings or whatever it is, then I think that it's perfectly legal to have these accounts.
Oh, absolutely, David. And not only that, I would declare it. I would tell them where it is. I would pay the taxes on any new income I earn, which I've always done in my life. I've never not paid taxes on the money that I received, used, and benefited from. What I didn't pay taxes on was money that I managed that belonged to others. It'd be like charging the president of Citibank with not paying taxes on the hundreds of billions of dollars that sits in their vault that belong to their customers. But I definitely will be continuing to comply with all the U.S. tax laws. But at the same time, I need to, if I'm going to go back to working 16 hours a day building wealth for others, I'd like to be able to at least go out and buy a nice dinner and not sleep in the box on the street. So I'm going to work with appropriate advisors to do that in an appropriate and honorable way as I can do it while still protecting myself against having nothing.
So just to be clear for everyone, you're not hiding assets. You're talking about full disclosure, full tax payment, full reporting, just putting them outside where they could be easily seized by the government.
Yes. Yeah, they're setting it up so that I can actually have a debit card where I can go buy food, buy housing, buy other things, and not worry that the funds in that account will disappear between one day and the next.
Do you have any foreign travel I know you're still confined to the local regional area, but that ends next month, or in December. I mean, do you have any foreign travel restrictions after that? Are you able to travel overseas?
I have no restrictions at all. After December 29th, I am completely free of this ordeal. I am back to being a full citizen with whatever rights one still has here in the United States. I definitely am looking forward to getting – I travel a lot. And I have friends all over the world, and I'm definitely looking forward to taking a trip to Europe to catching up with my friends there sometime next year. And I think my new business will require a bit of travel, and I'm looking forward to doing that. I used to complain I was traveling too much, but I definitely am looking forward to getting on that airplane and going someplace else and feeling a little more freedom again.
Listeners, we're going to take our break. We're a little more than halfway through our program. Again, the toll-free number for those of you that can call, even if you're at work, 1-866-687-7223. If you live outside the United States and you would like to call and you don't have access to a toll-free number, email me and I will give you the direct line number that toll-free is connected to, and that way you could call it from whatever country you may be in. I know toll-free doesn't work in a lot of countries. Again, 1-866-687-7223. Back in about 3 minutes with Walt Anderson.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back, everybody. This is part two of our Friday program, and our guest today is Walt Anderson. You can give us a call. Our phone lines are open. And listeners, don't do like you always do and wait until the show's about to end and then you do an 11th-hour call. Call earlier, 1-866-687-7223 is our toll-free number. And, of course, you can email us at drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. Walt, I have a note here from Trent in Australia, and he's gotten up at 3 a.m. local time to listen live to this show and to participate and ask some questions. So here's his question. This Sunday, SpaceX is launching their rocket to the ISS. One of the payloads that they will be launching to the station is a commercial customer payload through NanoRacks, Jeffrey Manber. Now, if I recall, Jeffrey was part of your MirCorp purchase program that you were working on doing, so I'm pretty sure you know Jeff. What does Walt think of NanoRacks and their product?
NanoRacks is one of the positive benefits of commercial space. In other words, the fact that now NanoRacks was able to do what it's doing, was able to get cooperation from NASA instead of resistance. NanoRacks is providing an extremely valuable service for researchers, because before, a researcher would try to get on the shuttle and would be delayed and problems. And for real research to be done, a researcher has to have multiple opportunities. They can't just test once and then wait 5 years to do it again, because research is an iteration of trying different things to find out what happens. With NanoRacks, you can very predictably book a space, and you know that the chances are very, very good that you're going to get the space and get that space and the timing agreed. And so a research organization or a researcher or a college or university can plan an activity, a logical strategy for doing their research and doing the, what they want to do. I think that NanoRacks is an exceptionally good idea and a very positive outcome for this type of the approach of getting payloads planned and coordinated.
Did you work with Jeff on your purchase of Mir efforts? Wasn't he part of that group?
Jeff was the president of the company and was critical in connecting me to the Russian people who ran the private company called RSC Energia. Jeff had worked with RSC Energia for many years and understood the culture there and the unique circumstances that RSC Energia was facing, being a private company in a space field that was dominated by more government-related organizations. And I think that the one part that went well was the gaining an understanding with the leaders of that company, RSC Energia, and coming to terms with them in relation to the plans for Mir. That went very, very well, and mostly because of Jeff's involvement. The part that didn't work very well was when the Russian Space Agency ordered RSC Energia to destroy this valuable and irreplaceable asset. But I definitely hope that I don't should say I hope NanoRacks does well. NanoRacks is doing well, and I hope that continues.
I've been fortunate to interview Jeff and talk about NanoRacks many times over the years, and they have my if I could give a high endorsement, which I don't do, the NanoRacks would have the highest. And Jeff is one of the most professional, business-oriented commercial space guys that I've ever come across. I have great respect for the company and him, and wish their whole operation great success. And they don't need my wishes. They're going along on their own and doing just darn dandy fine. And
exactly. And I really admire Jeff because he has faced some serious, you know, after Mir was destroyed, the company was destroyed, and it was destroyed by some conscious effort on the part. He's been able to fight his way back to a position of respect in the space community, and working with some of the same people that were actually ordered to damage his business, he's been able to succeed. And I think that's very positive and shows a great deal of strength of character on his part to do that. And I mean, I certainly hope I'm going to be able to do the same thing.
You know, there was a really strong business team for your Mir Corp, and plus you had the space enthusiasts along with you, like Tomlinson and others. Did any of you at all foresee just how horribly political and difficult, you know, this would turn out being? And did the Dennis Tito as the first space tourist, was that like the stick that broke the back, or whatever that expression is? And, I mean, is that what sent it over the top? Or how did this all happen? And I mean, just trying to buy it doesn't seem to me like it'd be such a horrific nightmare for anyone. You either can raise the money and do it and have an operating agreement for these guys to continue operating it or not. And it shouldn't have been competitive with the ISS, because the Russians weren't going to be putting any of their own money into it after you took it over, correct?
Well, the Russians were putting, there was a partnership, Mir Corps. I was providing the cash from some of the funds that I managed, and the Russian company, RSC Energia, was providing some in-kind functions, services and their employees' time and design and other things. So there was, but we certainly weren't taking any resources away from ISS. The Russians, the Russian Space Agency and RSC Energia, a contractor of the Russian Space Agency, had committed certain specific launches and resources to ISS, and the Russians, as a group, were critical to ISS's success because they launched much of the heavy payloads to ISS. ISS is not possible without the Russian participation, and the Russians own some of the real estate on ISS. So we weren't taking anything away from that at all. Now, the director of NASA at the time, Dan Golden, said we were taking away from that. He's a liar. We weren't, and he knows it. But he made this into a very political, challenging, problematic thing, and apparently his friends at the Bush 2 White House agreed, and I believe that's where this whole thing, my disaster, started. But I could never have, it occurred to me that simply doing a completely legal activity like this could lead to this kind of political firestorm. It just didn't occur to me, but then I'm not a very political person, and although I've lived in Washington all my life, I'm not very connected with the government by choice. Now, Gus Gardellini, one of our advisors to the company, seemed to be more aware of this and predicted some serious problems, and he was right. And I think Jeff also was more aware of it and was prepared to, was doing his best to ameliorate these problems. He had meetings with various officials at NASA and other agencies, and was trying to assure them that our goal was not to harm ISS, but it was simply to do what we wanted to do, to commercialize space. And we were actually, not-for-profit organization I'm involved in, FINES, was developing a electrostatic tether system that if it had been successful, if the State Department had actually allowed us to export this technology, which is what we built, the electrostatic tether system, and try it out on Mir, and if it worked, we were going to offer that technology at no charge to ISS. And that technology would have reduced the amount of launches they needed to do with payload fuel. So they would have been able to use their launch payload to put other things besides fuel, if this had worked. Now, we have no reason to believe it wouldn't work. In fact, we believe that it was going to work pretty well. But we were prevented. The State Department sort of gave us a little gotcha. They approved the export of the tether the day after the Mir went to its fiery grave in the Pacific Ocean. And I don't believe that's an accident, because they knew that we intended to test this device on the Mir station. That was part of our application. So I guess that was their little sense of humor. Having destroyed our business, they then decided to send us a little message. But we never occurred to us that this wasn't positive, that NASA wouldn't see the fact that if the tether worked and we could let them have access to it, that they could save energy, it was a good idea to have two space stations in orbit, that wouldn't hurt anything, that if we had been able to commercialize Mir, one of our plans with RSC Energia was to take the production line that they were running for the Soyuz manned capsule and get some outside investment to modernize certain areas and increase the capacity of that production line so that we would reduce the cost of producing these manned vehicles. We would make them more dependable through some additional modernizations, and they're already very dependable, but we would improve that dependability, and we would increase, we wanted to double the amount of vehicles produced, which would have given more, since the shuttle was going out of service, this would have given NASA more potential resources for launch. That was our plan. And this wasn't a secret plan. This was, we told anybody and everybody, including NASA officials and the government policymakers, but that didn't work. And surprisingly, there was an extremely negative response, and NASA officials began calling their contractors, telling them that if they did business with MIRCOR, they wouldn't get contracts. Well, that's an illegal act. Speaking of illegal acts, that's very seriously illegal to do that, to interfere with somebody's business or to threaten contractors with who they could do business with.
What was the role of Dennis Tito? Was he, did he, his influence in all of this? And I know that NASA was freaked out about his going to the ISS initially. Did that play a role in Mir?
Well, see, originally he was going to Mir.
Right, I know that was the original thing.
And although there's some stories out there that somebody, some company, little travel agency called Space Adventures brought Dennis Tito, that's not true. I have the contract where here. And on that contract, it said that if for any reason Mir was unavailable, inaccessible, we would take MIRCOR, Dennis Tito, to the ISS instead, because the Russian has real estate and even their own door.
They have their own sector, yeah.
So. They have their own sector, their own entrance. So they had every right to commit to that, and Arseniy Energia made that commitment, and thinking they'd never have to honor it, but it was there, and that way Dennis felt comfortable, Mr. Tito felt comfortable, knowing that no matter what happened, he would have a destination to go to. And the contract was signed. We planned to send him to Mir. He began training based on the assumption he would go to Mir. And everything seemed fine. And, well, when Mir went down, we still had to honor our contract. And our Russian partners still had to honor our contract, which we did. That was when NASA freaked out. They thought they'd solved the problem and killed commercial space by killing the Mir. But all they'd done is bring it to their front door. Now Mr. Tito was going to be on their station. He was going to get 24-hour coverage TV worldwide on their station.
And that was a huge amount of press that that story got, and not NASA's finest day.
That's right. And NASA looked like, they looked like bullies and nasty and unfair and sour grapes and all things, but they did it to themselves. I mean, Tito would have gotten a lot of publicity going to Mir, but not as much as going to ISS. So they...
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, and in the end, it turned out that the actual NASA employees, the astronauts, cosmonauts on board ISS, were not part of this political thing. They were excited to have somebody else come on board. They were excited about the idea. They were very gracious to Mr. Tito. It was the top of the NASA organization, the political weasels, I might say, who were creating negative things about something that was very positive. But I think NASA got what they deserved, because by destroying our business, it came right to their front door, and I think that contributed to the atmosphere that we now have, the new policies of the current government, which are more open to commercial space. And I'm not saying it wouldn't have happened, but I think Mr. Tito's insisting on making the trip and his being there and NASA's resistance to it made them look foolish enough that it has been hard for them to resist commercial space, and now they don't do that anymore.
Well, I was just going to say, I finally got to meet Dennis earlier this year at some of the early planning meetings for bringing Endeavour to Los Angeles, and Dennis hosted one of those original or initial museum meetings at his residence. Couldn't ask for a nicer, friendlier, more gracious person. I mean, I found him to be just really genuine through and through, and very eager to continue doing things in space, would like to go back up to space again. And, you know, it's just a lousy story that happened. But, you know, I was very impressed with my one and only meeting. That, I mean, we sat down at the dessert table, and there were the crew of Endeavour was there, the last crew, Mark Kelly and others, and I mean, we just had a great time with Dennis. I mean, he was approachable, just a fabulous person.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of great stories. I mean, Dennis never gave up. He was determined to do it, and he did it, and you can't take that away from him, and he succeeded brilliantly in doing what he wanted to accomplish. He paid for it. He got MIRCOR honored its contract, and we were proud of that. There's a story about Dennis Tito showing up. Part of his training involved having to be trained at the NASA facility in Houston. So he shows up at the door of NASA ready to get the training that he's required to take in the American facility. And NASA officials freak out and they won't let him in. And they call Jeff Mamber, who's helping to coordinate, and all sorts of fur is flying. And Jeff Mamber, the president of AmeriCorps, coordinates and works and smooths the feathers. And ultimately, Dennis Tito is allowed in and allowed to train because otherwise the Russian government is prepared to withdraw from ISF. Basically, the Russian government drew a line in the sand and said, look, we're keeping all our agreements. You keep yours. And they insisted that the U.S. government take the steps so that they could honor their agreements with Mr. Tito. And they won through because they were right. It was purely a matter of contracts, honor, and agreements. And ultimately, NASA backed down. And there's a lot of interesting stories like that, Mira, that haven't really been told and probably would only be interesting to hardcore space enthusiasts.
You do have a caller on hold, but did Dan Golden come to visit you when you were in lockup?
No, I was hoping to see him in the next cell for his illegal intimidation of U.S. contractors. But that never happened, surprisingly.
And he didn't come to visit you or anything?
No, he didn't send me a letter of apology or anything.
You do have a caller. Hi, caller. Who are you, please?
Hi, this is Rick Tomlinson, the enthusiast.
Ah, hello there, Rick. How are you doing?
Very good. I don't usually call in on these things. I have listened before, David, and you do a great show. I just had to call in and weigh in with Walt and when you were talking about the Tito affair. Walt kind of said it there just a moment ago, but what was interesting was, you know, we never, in the initial planning phase, we never planned on going in any way, as somebody might perceive it, head-to-head with NASA. We were, in the initial phase, going to put a tether on this thing, because if you keep in mind that they wouldn't let us fly, build that tether because of the ITAR considerations, that meant that Jeff and Walt and their team had no time to put a business plan, et cetera. The joke was, you know, they were learning how to swim in a pool full of sharks while somebody was shooting at them with an Uzi from the side of the pool. As far as putting a plan together, creating a credible business, the goal originally was to store the mirror using the tether until we figured out what to do with it. And then when we, Walt, you know, I'm sure he remembers the meeting where we said, well, we're not going to be able to do that. How we pay the rent, and that's when the idea of the Dennis Tito thing came up. We literally weren't sitting out to create a space hotel or anything. It was in there and stuff. Walt can tell you what the real purpose was in the long term, but we just needed to pay the rent.
Interesting. Hey, Rick. Before the show started, Walt told me about a special offer with your Earthrise Institute and his signature. You guys want to talk about that since you're on the phone?
I'll tell. There's been some rumors that somehow Rick has started an organization called the Earthlight Institute, and in the last 24 hours, I've just gotten information about it, something called Overview and Statement of Purpose. I had heard some rumors about it, but I really didn't know what it was, and I had nothing to do with it until the last 24 hours. And in the last 24 hours, Rick said he might want to sell the Orphans of Apollo disc, which tells a more detailed story of the mirror with some real photos and actual video from that event. And I said, okay, well, you sell it and raise money for your new Earthlight Institute, and I'll sign copies if that'll help or hurt. If it'll hurt, I promise not to sign it. So Rick said that for $30 contribution, he'll send the disc, the Orphan Apollo disc, and first send it to me for signature to raise money for his new initiative.
Yeah, the unsigning one. I love that. And that way we won't send it to you, and it'll be unsigned.
You can promise not to send it to me as part of the contribution. Maybe they can contribute $45 if you don't send it to me and I don't sign it.
That's it. That's it. There you go. The organization is yourflightinstitute.org. And you just go on there. There's a we haven't got the website up, so there's a coming soon sign, you know, page up, and you can hit the donate button. We're in the middle of our 501c3 thing, and a lot of the projects we're working on, several of them, like Permission to Dream and some others, were projects that when we were doing finds, we did try and work on, and concepts that we were trying to support that kind of got, and I'm going to use the word loosely, orphaned when we could no longer support them. So we're just trying to pick those back up. But I wasn't calling in to make a plug. I was actually calling in on the other subject.
Well, I just was aware of it, so I thought it with you on the phone, it's a good time to make the plug. So $45 for no Walt signature, $30 with a Walt signature, right?
That's the
deal. You know what? We'll take the $45 and Walt will find it.
For another $100, we can arrange for an Apollo astronaut not to sign it.
Right. Buzz Aldrin will not sign it. For another
$100. Okay.
And it will not have gone to the moon.
All right. Anything else, Rick?
No, I just wanted, I was really wanting the context, and the reason I called in on that one particular topic is because there's been some misstatements of what we were doing with the Mir, that it was supposed to be a space hotel, and it was about that ugly word, space tourism, and all of that. And that wasn't where we were going. We were going into a much grander thing that I'll let Walt talk about. You need to ask him about that. But that these people were ways of paying the bills to help leverage one of the most important activities of the human species. And it was never, let's go get some rich tourists. We had to pay the rent. And I'll sign off with that. And great to chat with you, David and Walt. And have a good talk.
Thanks a lot, Rick. I appreciate your call. Listeners, that does free up our toll-free line, 1-866-687-7223. Walt, knowing with 100% absolutely perfect hindsight, which everyone now has, especially you, would you do it again?
You mean the mayor?
Yes.
Oh, yes. How cool is that? I had a space station. I mean, seriously. I mean, we had a space station, and we had a launch, a private launch to our private space station, and we got to dream about changing the world in a positive way, even though it didn't work out. The dreams themselves were valuable. So I would do it again.
Okay, and you have another follow-up from Trent in Australia. Walt, would you like to speculate on what you think might happen to the space station when the time comes for NASA to abandon it?
I mean, the International Space Station.
Right. It's supposed to retire around 2021, but I know that they're doing studies on it to see if they can take it out to 2028. So, but at some point, they'll retire it. Do you think it, you know, would have a chance of being turned over to private parties? Could it be? Is it too big and too complex and the structure with the international partners too complex for that?
Well, actually, what was sort of sad about ISS is that the technology that it's using, that it was actually built with, is not significantly more advanced than what Mir was built with. They for whatever reason, didn't really advance technology. They've obviously placed smaller electronics, better air handling systems, and some other things inside of it. But its basic construction and design was really 20 years old and not very advanced. Saying that, it's still a big piece of metal up there. When the time comes, I hope that I have am no longer living in a box on the street and have the ability to bid on it.
So you think it might have a life after government retirement?
It's something to think about, and I certainly would like to be able to go I'd like to go up there and take a look at the premises and check it out and then perhaps put a bid in.
You want to go up and kick the tires, so to speak.
Exactly, right? Exactly.
Well, you know, hopefully there'll be a cheap way for you to go up there and do that.
Oh, I think by that time Elon Musk will be offering manned missions at a very low cost.
Alan in Houston sent in an email, and he says, Walt, while you were away on your holiday, the suborbital industry has been turned upside down. So it's likely that Virgin and possibly X-Corp will start some sort of commercial operations next year. There is this whole program that has developed while you were inside called Citizen Science with a secondary source of revenue for suborbital. Have you been able to stay up on this, and what do you think about the potential beyond space tourism for the suborbital industry?
Well, that's a big question, and I don't know if I have more than just speculations about it. Certainly, there's a lot of people want to take that ride, we've seen, and that's exciting, and I hope that should be a great view when they get up there. Citizen Science is very positive because you never know where an advance is going to come from, and having more creative minds doing more things is always good. So I think that it's certainly positive in that way. Where this is going to go, where it's going to lead, suborbital is suborbital. And one way it might lead is to, instead of just going up and down, maybe you go up in Los Angeles and come down in New York. Maybe it leads to the beginning of some very fast transport for trips around the world. I'm not sure. I've been talking to a lot of people and arguing with them about whether the technology can be translated to doing those things, and we haven't come to any agreements yet, but there's some possibilities we can get some other commercial benefits from this technology, and just the ability to go up every day, many times a day, allows the opportunity for a lot of science to be done in both zero G and in observation near the edge of the Earth atmosphere.
Here, Todd is in San Diego with another email. Says, David, I'm one of those listening at work, can't use the telephone, but please ask Walt if he has stayed up on how things have changed with the Space Frontier Foundation New Space Conference Business Plan competition. It seems to me that that program has really evolved over the last 6 or 7 years from occasional quarterly meetings to a real program with real contestants giving away real money. Has Walt paid attention to that? Does he know about the companies and the kinds of business plans they've submitted?
The answer to that is I've heard about it, but because of where I was, it was hard to get access to the actual materials. I hope to be able to attend some of those events, and I'm actually looking for. I've been invited, and I'm looking forward to attending some of those events and seeing more about it, because it does sound very interesting, so and a very positive thing, but I really can't say more until I go there.
Do you have any restrictions on being involved with a nonprofit, a 501c3? Is that part of any of your rights that you lose as a prisoner? Because I know, like, you can't own a firearm and you can't vote, supposedly. What happens with nonprofits?
I didn't own a firearm before, and when you look at the in this country, when you look at the weasels that ultimately run for office, voting is not the most attractive thing, and I'm not missing it too much. But I don't lose anything else. I can run any business, any type of not-for-profit I can start, run, operate, or do. There's people who, let's say somebody who gets charged with securities fraud or something, then because they've harmed the public, they may be barred from, let's say, being a stockbroker again or something. That wasn't the case with me. The only person I supposedly harmed was the United States government, and they have not barred me from paying my future taxes.
No, of course they're not going to do that. Are you kidding? if they were really sane and rational, they would have put you on 7 years controlled probation, thrown you back out in the job market so that you could produce another set of hundreds of millions of dollars of companies and tax the hell out of you.
Yeah, but this isn't about rational. It's about fear. Next person that tries to do something that might not be popular with the U.S. government is certainly going to think twice. It's about fear.
Are you planning to be involved with any of the space advocate nonprofit organizations? Are you coming back into Space Frontier Foundation, National Space Society, Mars Society, anything like that?
Well, I'm going to start out with I'll be going to the next Space Frontier Foundation meeting, like many other space enthusiasts, and I will probably join some of the other organizations just to get their routine publications. I intend to be involved, and to the extent that there's been some minor controversy about the issues related to my past criminal charges against me by the U.S. government, and I'm hoping that whether you believe that I was guilty or not, I can put that behind me, because if I was, in fact, guilty, then I have definitely paid for my crime. I was tortured, abused, and denied medical care, sleep deprivation, sensory deprivation. I paid for my crime many times, if you want to consider the kind of punishment I suffered, if you believe I'm guilty. I wasn't guilty. I didn't do anything wrong. I was a political prisoner. That's still over. And I have the same skills I had before to create prosperity and to do positive things. And I'm not going to stop trying to do that. I'm going to try to enter every door that's open to me that is positive and move forward.
Alex is in Seattle, Washington, and says, Walt, do you have more of an interest in the future of human spaceflight or the continued development of commercial space business ventures, robotics, science, things like that, but not necessarily human spaceflight?
I think it's a 50-50. I mean, I genuinely believe, like many of the other people who are working in this field, I believe that humans must put us in some portion of our population off the planet. And my personal favorite place is to put them in large habitats that we build or create using the resources out off of Earth. At the same time, the technology for robotic activities has advanced tremendously, and why would we not want to do things using robotics and technology at a low cost that will advance and benefit mankind? But I think I want to do both, and I'd like to see humans going out and exploring our universe when it's possible.
Would you do a one-way Mars trip?
No.
Okay. Here's another question for you. Can you stay a few more minutes for these questions that keep coming in?
Sure.
Okay. Joe is in San Antonio, Texas, and he says, Walt, recently Planetary Resources, a new startup company, announced big plans for asteroid mining. We know that you've been interested in this subject. Have you followed Planetary Resources? Do you have any thoughts on what we know publicly about their business plan? And do you think that they're on a solid track? There is also another venture being done by the B612 Foundation, which is a little bit different. But do you think that there really is going to be a near-term commercial benefit with asteroid mining, Planetary Resources notwithstanding?
Okay, well, I talked a little earlier about my belief that asteroid mining is a viable economic thing. From what I can tell about Planetary Resources, right now they're just mining credit cards. I know a little bit both parties who are sort of the founders of that company. And one way that I sometimes use as a businessman when I'm evaluating investments and management teams is I look at whether the management team is about doing or being. And the companies that have been successful that I've been involved in or that I've invested in have a management team and lots of people associated with the management team interested in doing, meaning people that do things, that put their head down and get things done, and not people that are so interested in being in front of the cameras and self-promoting. And the company you're speaking about is a company that's led by two people whose entire be-all and end-all and every breath they take is about getting credit and being important. And I don't think that's a good combination for the two leaders of a company that has to do some highly technical and very difficult tasks in a harsh environment. I don't think it's good for investors, and I think it might be extremely dangerous for anybody that works for them whose life and safety will probably be very secondary to the egos of the people involved. I wouldn't get in a car driven by either of those people, not to mention a spacecraft. And as I say, I'm not running for office, so I don't have to be nice to people that I or say nice things that I don't believe. There are other companies. I've heard of another company that is going to be announcing sometime, I think, in the fall, that is doing, has a similar idea, asteroid mining, and I think that they may have a management team that's a little more do and less be. I actually, Peter Diamandis, who's one of the leaders of the other company, I actually spoke to him about asteroid mining back in 1988-89, and me and Todd Hawley and him were in a Colorado hotel room, and we had a meeting, and we were drinking a little bit, and we started talking about asteroid mining, and Todd and I had some very specific technical, you know, facts and knowledge about it. We're very enthused and actually believed it was very real, and I think we provided the education, minimum education, on that subject, and now I'm very sorry I did that, but it can't be, you can't take back a lot of things that happen in life.
Do you think that just in general, without thinking about any companies or people, because I don't really want to go down that road at all, but if on a scale of 1 to 10 for being extremely risky and not ready to, which would be 10, I mean, which would probably be 0, and being really ready or close to ready, which would be up on the upper end, resource mining in situ, in space, rather than bringing the stuff back to Earth. Are we around a 5 midway on the scale? Are we closer to...
You're talking about something maybe on the moon, for example?
Well,
or?
it could be moon. I mean, you know, we do a lot of programs.
Asteroid Earth. I think we've got... I saw Space Studies Institute, some things they did 15 years ago, where they were sort of studying and looking at the fact of doing in-situ mining on the moon through robotics, and was having some automation and some humans on Earth that would help the robots along when they got confused. And it seemed like the technology is certainly there to do that. So that's I think, more than a 5. I think that's getting up into 7 or 8 or 9. And the real issue is how strong are these devices, and how much will they break down, and how many people need to go out and fix them?
we do a lot of programs in support of cislunar economic development, which does require at some point, lunar resource, development and working and extrapolation and stuff like that. Do you think starting this process on the moon, which is closer, makes more sense, or just go to a NEO first?
I think the moon makes sense. We know it's there. We know what's on it. Some of the materials on the moon can be very useful. We have nickel iron and some aluminum components. So we can launch them. Again, Space Studies Institute did the experiments with the magnetic rail. International Space University, a university I helped found, did a study on the moon base, I think their first year. And none of those things have been shown to be wrong. We can do that. We can mine the moon, and the materials from the moon would be ideal for building a solar power satellite, because they're metal materials. We could build a massive, huge solar power structure out of the moon materials, and then we could take the small amounts of gallium arsenide and other electronic components we needed from Earth, but it wouldn't be of a very high payload weight, and put together a nice solar power satellite at a very low cost. And if it worked out, we could build a lot more from the moon resources.
Well, that may be a good way to start, and maybe closer and just around the corner, hopefully. So I guess one of the other questions I would ask you, that we hear a lot of policy questions, and we address it a lot on the space show about what the NASA budget should be. Should it be reduced? Should it be, expanded? Are, projects like SLS gobbling up too much on one side, or James Webb on the other side? Do you see the NASA budget as a significant element in moving forward with space development and exploration? Do you see NASA as at some point being overtaken by the commercial industries?
Well, if this is an area where I might have trouble, I'm not very unbiased about NASA because of my past history with them. At the same time, there's a lot of people working for NASA doing great work. There are a lot of dedicated scientists, researchers, and space enthusiasm that want nothing more than to advance the cause of development of space, and they're looking at it very positively. Unfortunately, any institution of the American empire is going to be led by people that have different goals. And so it's a question that I have trouble answering, but I hope that NASA can continue with the budget it has to do some of the positive projects they've done recently, like the Martian exploration and some other things that have worked out very well and shown that there are people in NASA that really do get it and are doing the very best work they can.
Listeners, we're coming up to conclude our discussion with Walt today. If you do want to call in, you need to do it. Otherwise, you're going to miss the opportunity. 1-866-687-7223. And Walt has said things that to some of you may be very controversial. He'll take your hard questions and challenges and answer them as best he can. You know, if you want to call in and take him to task or disagree, or even do that by email in the remaining minutes of the program, go right ahead. And again, 1-866-687-7223. Walt, do you want to put out any contact information? Are you interested in follow-up with any listeners who want to chew at you or praise you or just ask you legitimate questions?
I'm not this time. I'm a little bit unsure of where I'm going to be and how I'm going to be contacted, so I'm not ready to do that yet.
Okay, so can I forward email to you?
Absolutely. You can forward anything to me, and I'd love to hear the response to this talk and just in general what people think about what's going on in space and how we can move forward in a positive way.
So if you get challenging or disagreeing questions or comments, you're willing to have those come into you?
I obviously send everything. I mean, you don't filter. If somebody, whatever they think is fine. I've been through a lot in the last 7 years. I can certainly take a little criticism if that's what's coming.
any closing comments, pearls of wisdom, something you would like to leave us with today?
Just a final thought. I genuinely believe that the world is at a crossroads in relation to the human beings now have the ability to substantially shape and change the world. And I believe we're at a crossroads in the way we do this. There is evil in the world, and the tools of evil are ignorance, fear, and violence. But evil can be resisted, and the tools to do that are knowledge, tolerance, and peaceful purpose. And with knowledge, tolerance, and peaceful purpose, I think we can build a sustainable world and a prosperous future for everybody on this planet. And I do believe the resources and technologies already exist to do that, and of course they can be improved. And I genuinely believe, as I have my entire life, that the development of space resources are a part of this process and are an important part of the future. And I intend to be a part of that effort, along with many other people.
Walt, we're again welcoming you back, I'm sure the time will fly real quickly until December 29th, when all of your restrictions are lifted, and I look forward to seeing you at New Space if you're going to be there next year, and I guess around the area of NASA Ames, Silicon Valley. And thank you for coming back and keep us posted. And we'd like to follow your progress. And when you're making new announcements about your upcoming business, let us know. And I'm sure we'll be talking to you again in the future.
All right. And David, I want to thank you. Even during the worst of times, you've kept the door open to communication with me. And that's been very positive of you and helpful to me to have that door open, and I really thank you for that.
Well, you know, and I've posted this on some blogs that were critical of the space show for giving you a forum, as well as other things. And, you know, America, Walt, is supposed to be about people being able to have second chances, whether we fail financially or have our homes foreclosed or, you know, we make mistakes and we pay a debt back to society. And, you know, none of us are so big and powerful and so, you know, splendid in our own lives where we have a right to turn on that American principle, which is people get second chances in America, sometimes third and fourth chances. And, you know, I don't believe you abandon friends. And, you know, sometimes people do some really stupid, horrible things, but you don't abandon friends any more than you would abandon your son or your daughter, you know, for having a problem or doing something really stupid. So, you know, I've been fine staying in touch with you, and I have another friend who has also been incarcerated for something he did, Courtney State, and I stay in touch with Courtney as well. And that's just what we do in this country. That's part of what makes us so great and so much more powerful and in our greatness, even beyond, you know, our governments and society structures and, you know, the kind of more formal parts of how we all live our lives. So staying in touch with you has not at all been an effort. I'm glad we had email contact. That made it a lot easier, trust me.
Yes.
And, you know, I'm just glad you're out, and I wish you the best of luck as you pursue a new beginnings. And I'm glad you're still in the space community.
I appreciate that. I never was very concerned about my reputation, didn't even think about it until more recently now. But I look back and I think, well, it took me 25, 30 years to build up a good reputation, and every day was another effort of doing the right thing and running businesses the right way, helping people. And it only took 10 minutes for some grade C prosecutor to tear that all away. And it's amazing how easy it was for them to do that, the way things are structured. But I hope that I have the opportunity to prove that my prior reputation is the real truth of the matter. And I'm hoping I get that opportunity to do that.
Well, you have that opportunity. I think you're, from what I know, your business expertise is second to none. And we look forward to following and hearing from you and staying abreast of how you work in the space community and the larger communities. And I'm sure you'll be back on the space show down the road.
Well, good. I look forward to it, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Listeners, we have open lines on Sunday. And look, I have a thick skin, too, listeners. If you want to attack me and go after me for giving Walt airtime and talking to him and letting him speak his mind and be controversial, you know, let it pour, okay? I can take it just as Walt can take it. And I'm just going to tell you up front, I'd rather take your crap and hear, you know, your hate mail than compromise my values, my integrity, my ethics, and what I believe in for the United States. And we have a free country. We're a country of giving people opportunities and second chances and the opportunities to correct mistakes if we've made them. And whether you believe in that or not is your own personal, you know, issue. But you're not going to take that away from the space show. That's how we run this program, and that's what we're going to continue to do with people. And we don't drop our friends when they get in trouble. I don't drop my friends when they have illness or financial problems or lose their homes or something else. I'm not going to drop my friends when they have legal problems. And if you're compelled to do hate mail and to be PO'd and all of that, hey, go for it. You know, I got thick skin just like Walt, and I will reply to you, but you pretty much know what I'm going to say back to you. And again, Walt, great having you back on the show. Open lines on Sunday, everybody. Then we've got our audition show on Tuesday the 16th. I hope a lot of you who would like to be guests on the space show take advantage of it and give us a call on that Tuesday evening. October 16th. Thank you all for listening today, and to Walt for being back with us and being on the Space Show. Goodbye from Walt Anderson and the Space Show.